I, Greg Perry, the Historic Preservationist, welcome to Season 3, Episode 83. So today's episode is going to circulate around pre-revolutionary furniture makers of New York City. I mean, I always have felt that the makers of New York City were many steps behind Philadelphia, and several behind Boston and Newport. But nevertheless, they have their own journey and story to tell. So let's get on with it. So, in fact, the generally accepted opinion seemed to be that prior to the Revolution, New York was a rather benign small town in which the torch of art, as compared with the shining luminaries of New England and Philadelphia, amounted to hardly more than a smoky and smelly grease lamp. And this despot, the imperfections conveyed by superb old silver and notably designed and fabricated artifacts of pewter cherished among the descendants of New York families, and the accompanying evidence afforded by significant portraits painted either by New York artists or by even outsiders who, like Copley, enjoyed a sufficient patronage to justify extended periods of residency in the city. For the majority of collectors, though, the history of early New York furniture began and ended with Duncan Fyfe, whose introduction to the United States did not occur before 1838, and whose modest entry into the future American metropolis was thereafter postponed for at least another decade. But of late, however, the former attitude of indifference has undergone a materialistic change. The finding of a chair catalogued by Israel Saxale in January of 1932 as a Philadelphia item, but on further investigation, revealing a written inscription from the hand of Gilbert Ash of Wall Street, caused a mild sensation, to put it vaguely. This was intensified by a sofa in the Metropolitan Museum. The two events were sufficient to stimulate a search for other identifiable pieces of New York craftsmanship and for the names of the men who might have made them. Some measure of reward has crowned this effort, though the results obtained by independent investigators are still incomplete and, to a considerable extent, uncorrelated. Among such items are examined are certain chairs that have supplied the most reliable material for tentative stylistic comparatives. And these, I am quite satisfied to point to the conclusion that, just as the anti-revolutionary days, a fairly well-defined zone of Philadelphia influence reached perhaps as far north as Trenton, New Jersey, and to the southward area, even to the Carolinas. So, likewise, may be recognized as a New York zone that apparently stretched from Albany at the one extreme to the upper counties of New Jersey at the other, and probably extended eastward to nearby Connecticut communities. As for the characteristics by which furniture created in the latter zone may be identified, it is essential at the present juncture to speak with extreme caution, and to combine the discussion exclusively to chairs. So with regard to the latter, it may be observed, subject to correction and contradiction, that the stump leg and the penetrating tenon, long supposed to be exclusive marks of Philadelphia workmanship, were both employed by New York makers. New York chair legs and the club type are, however, seemingly less carefully rounded than their Philadelphia analogues. Sometimes, indeed, they are chamfered to a virtually hexagonal form. In chairs exhibiting penetrating tenon and stump leg, or only one of these features, it may be necessary to determine the source by reference of the backsplat. If the latter is interlaced in the manner peculiar to Philadelphia, there may be no further question as to source. But if it shows usual scrolls cushioned on a lower element, ascription to the New York zone seems inescapable. Philadelphia chairs, which mingled Queen Anne and Chippendale features, also occur. But in these, the combination of pierced Chippendale splat and rounded Queen Anne seats appears to be invariably accompanied by a balloon-shaped back, which is similar to that employed during the earlier period. Sir William Johnson's chairs, on the other hand, which are probably New York items, display a fully developed Chippendale back, legs, and elaborately carved knees, and claw and ball feet, associated with an old-style rounded type seat. So it may, further, be well to compare the seat frame construction of one of these Johnson chairs with that of a Philadelphia round seat example. The differences between the two will be at once perceived. The Philadelphia seat is cut from wide planks, so that its interior open space constitutes a virtual rectangle, heavily enclosed. The legs are dowelled into the seat boards instead of being built onto the frame. The rim, for holding the slip seat in place in a separate piece glued to the substantial seat frame. So, in the beginning, though, detail of the Sir William Johnson chair, it is easy to see that the legs are so built into the seat frame as to become a structural part of the latter, and that the protective rim is integral with the relatively light rails. So, insofar as observation may justify opinion, New York carving is, in general, less clearly defined than, say, that of Philadelphia or Newport, less vigorous than the work of Philadelphia craftsmen, where scroll and leaf forms adorn the knees of New York chairs. The scrolls frequently lack the emphasis of a corresponding profile in the bracket of the leg itself. Again, the rear seat rail of some New York chairs inclines to thinness, so much as to necessitate its building out with shims to supply a bearing for the corner braces of the frame. This, however, is not a specific characteristic, but may be found in less exaggerated forms among Philadelphia pieces and in some New York items, though they may be hardly any evidence there. A number of the features cited to accompany a contribution that represents the first comprehensive attempt to assemble a list of pre-Revolutionary War New York furniture makers, and from the Megra records available, to construct a fairly reliable picture of the men and their accomplishments. Besides the portrayals of now familiar items, repeated for the sake of ready comparison, pictures of some hitherto unpublished articles of furniture that stem from New York or may reasonably be credited to that of the neighborhood are included. The presentation as a whole is, of course, inadequate. From some standpoints, it would, no doubt, be better to keep all the findings under cover until a sufficient array had been assembled to permit a full analysis and to validate ultimate conclusions. But, where a new field in the process of exploration is occurring, the greater the number of alert eyes focused upon it, the more speedy will be the discovery of whatever wealth it may be harboring from us. Examples of pre-revolutionary furniture thus far brought to light lend little encouragement to the hope of encountering any New York productions as highly distinguished as the best that Philadelphia has yet yielded. But nevertheless, if further investigation unearths sufficient data to assist assured recognition of New York types and to facilitate their classification by localities, a long forward step will have been achieved toward a complete understanding of early American furniture. A picturesque cluster of houses interspersed with winding lanes and streams and that bespoke a Dutch tradition was the city of New York at the dawn of the 18th century. Poised on the very tip of Lower Manhattan Island, this little community presently became an outlet for the business enterprises of numerous prosperous landowners whose scattered estates covered wide areas of Long Island, Staten Island, Upper Manhattan, Westchester County, Dutchess County, and Albany, and even spread over to neighboring territories such as New Jersey. Down the riverways that surrounded the island, the landed gentry sent their raw materials to the merchants of the city, who, in turn, shipped them to England, to the West Indies, and the distant shores. Imported goods from local city merchandise together return. New York probably carries on a more extensive commerce than any town in the English North American provinces, wrote the famous traveler Professor Kalm in 1748. At least, it may be said, to equal them. Boston and Philadelphia, however, come very nearly up to it. The trade of New York extends to many places, and it is said that they send more ships from thence to London than they do from Philadelphia. The leading families, like the Remsens, Raljas, and the Nicolls of Long Island, the Stuyvesants, the Bayards, and the Delanceys of Manhattan, the Heathcotes of Westchester, the Van Resslers of Albany, and the Beekmans and Schulers of Dutchess County, wield a tremendous influence in political and social affairs. Their homes were in keeping with their exalted position. Fine imported furniture and that of local cabinet makers filled their mansions. The patronage of such folk must have given the New York craftsmen ample opportunity to exercise their talents. Besides, if we may trust the advertisements of various shopkeepers, helping to maintain sundry dealers in foreign household gear. Such being the case, one may well wonder why the pre-revolutionary arts of New York City have been overshadowed by those of Boston and Philadelphia. It is impossible that these social forces of the latter cities have been more consistently centralized than those of New York, or that their character of their people has been less cosmopolitan, and simply that the present-day New Yorker, since in the many instances he hails from distant localities, has merely neglected to investigate the minor moments of his community's historical background. However, situation is now changing. The pride of the New Yorker has been aroused. The diligent effort is being made to unearth and identify all the finer examples of the city's early handicrafts that have been so well preserved. The central location of the city of New York rendered its subject to the influences from other great cities, Philadelphia perhaps in particular. This circumstance may account for the difficulty of determining that the precise characteristics of New York City colonial craftsmanship. Thus, one John Kelso advertised himself in a New York newspaper in 1774 as a Windsor chairmaker. So, having served as a regular apprenticeship in one of the first shops in that way in Philadelphia. In the same year, Adam Gaylor, also a Windsor chairmaker, announces his arrival from Philadelphia. An article by Harold Gillingham in the Bulletin of the New York Historical Society, we are told of Alexander Anderson, cabinet maker and joiner, Robert Allen, carver and gilder, and John Brown, upholsterer, who worked for Charles Thompson, a Philadelphian temporarily residing in New York. So, their receipted bills and reserve are well preserved among the documents of the Historical Society of Pennsylvania. And it is possible that the pieces of New York City furniture found their way to the vicinity of Philadelphia and have been accredited to the craftsmen of that section. Conversely, it is reasonable to surmise that some Philadelphia pieces found their way back to New York. Between the two types of confusion certainly has existed for many years. An instance of this is cited in Antiques Magazine for March of 1923. A chair widely accepted as a Philadelphia specimen was found to have been made and inscribed by Gilbert Ash, a New York City craftsman. It may be interesting to add that Ash resides, besides being a joiner, cabinet maker, soap boiler, and constable of the West Ward, is mentioned in a copy of the New York Mercury of 1756 as the maker of an organ used at a benefit concert. The furniture-making business was divided into numerous branches that were not always sharply differentiated. There was the joiner, or the cabinet maker, the chair maker, the Windsor chair maker, the carver, the turner, and the upholsterer. Some joiners did only carpentry work, but there were others who practiced chair making. Thomas Gregg announces in the New York Mercury during 1768 that he is a joiner and cabinet maker, and carries on a business in all its branches. In 1753, Robert Wallace, joiner, announces in the Gazette that he makes all sorts of cabinets, secretaries, desks and bookcases, drawers and tables, either square, round, oval, and chairs of any fashion. James Strachan, carver and cabinet maker, advertises that his partnership with David Davison has been broken by death, and that he hopes to carry on the business in its various branches. Beside importing diverse household goods, he declares himself ready to undertake house carvings of every kind, gilding, and all sorts of cabinet work. Thomas Burling was working in 1774 as a cabinet and chair maker at the Sign of the Chair in Beckman Street. He, or his successor of the same name, continued in business until long after the Revolution. John Parsons, a joiner, advertises in 1754 that he makes all sorts of cabinet work, sitting and easy chairs, clothes stool chairs, and all the kinds of household furniture in that way. Upholsters not frequently combined cabinet work with their trade, but in 1766, that is what he was intending to follow, the cabinet and upholsters' businesses. And this will set sell at a public sale at the beginning of at the remaining store of dry goods and jewelry. Joseph Cox, one of the more enterprising upholsters of his time, first advertised his business in 1756. 17 years later, we find that he has diversified his trade to the extent of supplying cabinet work. In Rivington's Gazetteer in 1773, he lists all sorts of canopy, festoon, field, and tent beds, and furniture, also every sort of drapery, window curtains, likewise sofa, settees, couches, bergeons, French elbow, easy and corner chairs, back stools, and mews, rib-back, gothic, and rail-back chairs, ladies and gentlemen's desk and bookcases, cabinets, chest of drawers, commode dressing, and toilet tables, writing, reading, sideboard, card, and night ditto, clothes presses, and chest for china silvers, and fire screens, and brackets for lusters and bust, with every other article in the cabinet and upholstery branches, all finished in the newest taste and the greatest dispatch. So most of the descriptive information relating to these early craftsmen is to be found in the newspapers of their times. Nevertheless, it is not until after 1755 that one encounters an extensive advertising by the local furniture makers. Andrew Gautier was one of the first to proclaim his trade over a considerable period of time. In fact, the New York Gazette, at intervals throughout 1756 and the following year, his advertisements, accompanied by a picture of a Windsor chair, declare a large and neat assortment of Windsor chairs made in the best and neatest manner, and well-painted high-backed, low-backed, and sack-backed chairs and settees, or double-seated fit for a piazza or even in the garden. This ambitious workman must have used his trade as a stepping stone for politics. He was a member of the committee to draft a plan of Bridewell, altered the Conanties Market, and helped to fit up the room just above the assembly chamber, repaired and set up in City Hall, and perhaps many other odd jobs. In his later years, Guthrie, usually swamped by political duties, neglected his trade to assume the borders of the aldermen. So from 1738 till about the time of the revolution. He was elected to the Board of Aldermen and worked with many of the committees that forwarded the building of the city. The name of Daniel Gautier, perhaps the father of Andrew, is also to be found in the records of having worked in the city. In 1739, he was paid £1.04.03 for making a table for the assembly at Greenwich, and for fitting and fixing it afterwards at Mr. Rutger's other than his registration as a joiner in 1731, we have no clue to his work or even his relationship with Andrew. So among the cabinet makers who urged their claims in print were quite a number of those announcements indicate that there were well-established and enterprising citizens. Samuel Prince, who advertised from 1772 to 1776, did not limit his trade to local patronage. He made and sold all sorts of cabinet work to the nearest manor, and on the lowest terms. Orders for the West Indies and elsewhere completed on the shortest notice. He is also to have done excellent work. John Brenner came from London with 6 officers to establish himself as those American colonies. At the sign of the chair in New York City, he claimed to make every article in the cabinet, chair-making, carving, and gilding business. He carved all sorts of architectural Gothic and Chinese chimney pieces, glass and picture frames, slab frames, girandoles, chandeliers, and all kinds of moldings, and fronts pieces, and etc. Desk and bookcases, library, bookcases, writing and reading tables, commode and bureau dressing tables, study tables, china tables, and cases. Commode and plain chest of drawers, Gothic and Chinese chairs, and all sorts of ornamental kinds of field bedsteads, etc. Limitations of space make it possible to cite all the interesting newspaper advertisements in pre-revolutionary New York City furniture makers. As a whole, after the middle of the century, the quantity of these announcements affords ample evidence of widespread and successful pursuit of a semi-luxury trade. Complete records of the master craftsmen and whose identified examples of their work are, however, extremely rare. The numerous and extensive fires that devastated the city of New York after the Revolution probably obliterated many documents and destroyed quantities of household equipment. But yet I feel sure that further investigation outside the confines of New York City proper will unearth at least a little excellent furniture obviously made up in the shops of colonial New York or its environs. On a similar basis, less than half of the furniture makers who are known to have worked from the year 1700 to the Revolution failed to advertise their wares. A few names of non-advertisers have been discovered among the city records. In 1770, the Common Council ordered the mayor to issue his warrant to the treasurer of the city to pay John Watson on order of the sum of £8.5 for making 2 large mahogany armchairs for the use of the Common Council. 2 years earlier, the colonial treasurer was ordered to pay Joseph Powell £11.43 for making 2 bookcases and a large table for the use of the General Assembly. So where now are these chairs, and where is the compassionate furniture that was either served in public buildings or graced in the homes of the patrons up and down the Hudson on Long Island and in the northern counties of New Jersey before the Revolution? So my stage is set for the public reappearance of such an item as to have survived, an absolute survivor, there's no doubt. And this may advent to be quite unduly delayed. So, very interesting stuff, talking about the makers and stylistic features, and particularly chairs in New York City. Again, I feel that their definition of carving is a little bit lacking, but some are absolutely gorgeous, as we just mentioned some. But by and large, they had a lot of chairs made with square legs and stretcher systems. So, but unfortunately, these chairs don't bring much. Usually, it's a squat New York ball and claw foot with a little carving and pierced flat volutes, gadruning on the front edge and things like that, that make these chairs a real winner and make them jump. So that's Greg Perry, the historic preservationist, signing off. Thanks everybody for listening. Thank you.